Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Eurobytes. This is the December 30th, 2025 episode. It's going to be a wrap-up of the year, and we're going to be talking about the new security policy that President Trump has issued over the past weeks. There's a short version, there's a large-scale version. Today, with me are Christian and Fabian, who are both going to be talking about this. Merry Christmas to y'all, and great to see you too. And just before I'll leave you to it, I'm wishing you all viewers and listeners a very merry belated Christmas and a very happy new year. Fabian, you had some more time thinking, reading the strategy. What are your takes on this regarding Europe? Are we being diminished?
Thank you, Lucas. Thank you, Christian. Merry Christmas and a happy new year. As this year was already progressing to be quite the memorable year, just imagine what 2026 has in store for us. So, Trump policy, Trump national security strategy. The President of the United States issued a new national security strategy, which ends, in my opinion, ends the post-1945 American global liberal hegemony that we have known in the post-war era. I think that the United States, under the leadership of Trump, at least the Trump administration, and his foreign policy experts have issued a major policy shift. What is the major policy shift? The major policy shift is that regime change is over. The United States is no longer going to dictate to the world how to live, what ideology to have, what religion to have, what to believe in. Not that the United States ever promoted any type of religion, but one can make the case that liberalism is a religion too. And what many people don't know this, but when you look at the Bush administration, they were incredibly liberal. And I don't mean left liberal. I mean classical, almost classical liberal, and trying to implement all of that on the Balkans, Africa, and of course the Middle East. And we have now seen, after years and years of failure in this regard, those years are over. The years of institutions running the globe, policy being done by the United Nations, this multilateral cooperation is over. And we're headed back into a world of multipolarity. We're headed back into a world of power players. We're headed back into a world of, and this is really interesting, civilizational states. That being China, that being Russia, that being India, that being, in essence, Japan, and also the United States. And of course, since we're Eurobytes, we're asking the big question, what is Europe? Is Europe a civilization to its own? Are European states within Europe a civilization to themselves? We can ask the question, is there such thing as a German civilization? That is a probably the guiding question for the coming decade. Why? Because the European elites, I'm not talking about the people, I'm always going to make this distinction, the European elites in Brussels, in Berlin, in the capital cities, even in London and in Paris, do not want the current status to end. They do not want the European Union to end. They do not want NATO the way it is to end. They want everything the way it is to stay the same. They want to uphold the status quo because they have obviously benefited from the status quo. However, the way the status quo is running is not working anymore. Europe is is witnessing deindustrialization. There's no real economic growth. On the contrary, we're witnessing a birth decline, we're witnessing a demographic decline, we're witnessing an economic decline, We're witnessing a political decline. We're witnessing a military decline. And the most tragic of all, we're witnessing a spiritual decline. So at the moment, everything that made Europe great is not on the forefront. Everything that made Europe mediocre is running the show. And we are just witnessing this ship sink. I do want to make the point, though, that nobody in the way, or I'm not going to make the case or the argument that I believe that Europe is going to go under. I'm going to make the case that the way the elitist structure works in Europe, the European Union, the way NATO is structured, I don't see that surviving by the year 2035. I don't. What I do see, and this is where it comes into the Trump security strategy, which I find very fascinating, because every region in the world is mentioned. For example, let's talk about Asia. What is the headline? Asia, win with the economic future, prevent military confrontation. That would be the headline that the policy has for Asia, or the strategy has for Asia. Africa, etc. There's nothing to the relation of how they highlight Europe. Here's what they, here's the highlight. It says on page actually 25, it says the following: promoting European greatness. If you read the strategy, you can clearly see that there is a sentimental connection that the Christian West has towards one another. It is basically, as Trump said, you know, most Americans are of European stock and they hate the way that Europe is developing. They hate the way that freedom of speech is diminishing. They hate the way that it's becoming overboarding, bureaucratic, incredibly unfree, and just very lame, to put it in blunt terms. But at the same time, there is this strong belief in promoting European greatness. And I find that remarkable, because when you hear the European press talk about this new strategy, the only thing they talk about is the fear that they have of what Trump is planning to do. Because what is Trump planning to do? Trump is planning to, of course, support anti-European, and when I say European, I mean EU institutional actors, all of those political forces that want to basically end the European Union. And he is now rigorously promoting people that want to change Europe, perhaps turn Europe to back to what it was, or promote what Europe once was and revive that old spirit. The fact of the matter is that the American security policy or strategy is looking to have basically an independent Europe, which is back on its own feet and shows strength. And one of the things that probably drives people in the Trump administration nuts is the fact that whenever you talk to EU officials, they will tell you that the European Union is the greatest thing ever. And at the moment, it hasn't worked at all. It has not found any big solutions. And as I've stated all of those negative facts, there are many things that do not speak to the fact that this system, this whole structure, should be upheld. What's really interesting, though, is the leaked paper. I just quoted the official paper. The leaked paper says that the Trump administration wants to work with, and this is very interesting, Italy, Austria, Hungary, and Poland. These states, these nations, are seen as allies out of similar ideological beliefs to undermine the structure of the EU. There are two things that come to my mind. First, let's name it by its name. Austria-Hungary is back on the map. you know, just a side note, I find it fascinating that the last Austro-Hungarian emperor, the Blessed Karl, has probably the most shrines in the United States. So he has a big following among traditional Catholics, among traditional American Catholics. So, and looking at J.D. Vance and looking at the developments that are taking place there and looking at the developments of generally traditional Catholicism in the United States, who knows what impact that may have on the future? Anyways, when you look at those states, Poland, Hungary, Austria, Italy, they're all very close to Germany, and they're all sort of a cordon sanitaire. So in other words, somewhat of a belt. The question that I'm asking myself when I'm looking at this map and looking at the strategy and looking at what Trump is trying to do and basically trying to, you know, end the G7 or, you know, but instead start a platform of civilizational states that I mentioned earlier, being India, China, Russia, Japan, the United States, and not having any European states in this new platform. The question that I'm asking myself is he purposely punishing the Europeans? Is he trying to completely break the power of the Germans? What is the deal here? What's the plan here? Is this a divide and conquer strategy, or is this an attempt to end the power of Brussels, to end the power of Ursula von der Leyen, to end the power of German bureaucrats who are ruining essentially this continent by keeping it in mediocrity and demise? Your take.
Over to Lukas.
I couldn't agree more. I think one of the most important things is to understand that there's no hostility towards Europe. When you read through the strategy is very favorably written towards Europe, towards the European countries, towards the European populace. It is, however, not very positive towards the EU. And Fabian already quoted from the strategy, and there's one interesting thing. It says, the larger issues facing Europe include activities of the European Union and other transnational bodies that undermine political liberty and sovereignty, migration policies that are transforming the continent, trade and strife, censorship of free speech, and suppression of political opposition.
Your government doesn't care about you. That's why you need a medical emergency kit. It contains life-saving medications like ivermectin, Z-Pak, and antibiotics. Stock them before they block them.
A warm welcome here at the National Press Club. Welcome to the journalists, welcome to the Embra team, and welcome to the other guests that we have here. We're going to announce, and as some of you guessed it right when they came in, the first E2 order by an American operator. And that operator is Avello. We believe this is really a strategic shift to unlock profitability for the customer. I'm very pleased that we have Andrew Levy here as the CEO of Avello, and I'm very pleased to give the stage to share a little bit more about what Avello is going to do with the E2-195. Thank you very much.
Couldn't be more excited to be here as part of this historic announcement. We have such a great cultural fit as companies. So we're very, very excited to be Embraer's newest customer. We launched our airline in April of 21, and our target is focusing on small secondary airports of large metro areas. We've carried over 8 million customers since we started on 63,000 flights. And we've done all these things with 1,200 of the greatest crew members I could ever imagine having. And many of them are here with me today. This is the right airplane for us. It's going to open up opportunities for us that no other aircraft can serve. The best thing about the airplane, of course, is you will not find a middle seat on this airplane. It doesn't exist. We won't have any to offer. It's going to be the best cabin in the United States, and we're so excited about that. This is going to elevate our experience to the highest level, and we think our customers are absolutely going to love the airplane.
It's loss of national identities and self-confidence. And seriously, this is just one sentence that sums it up pretty well. We don't see any hostility from the US towards the Europeans. We do see hostility towards the EU, and this hostility, in my opinion, is for good reason. Not that I'm anti-EU. I think the EU started off on a good level, or the European Community on Coal and Steel started with a great ideal. The European Community itself then started on great ideals, bringing people together, improving economic situations, improving the livelihood of people, thus securing peace together with the OSCE, for example. But what we've seen over the past years is an alignment of the standard of living in Europe, which is great for everyone but Germans, which is great for everyone but Germans, Danish, the Dutch, the Luxembourgish, the Austrians, the Northern Italians, etc., the Swedish, the Finns. The EU has led to a situation where people are being kept down for others to strive. As a German-speaking person, this is sometimes hard to grasp. It's great to see that Poland is flourishing this much, but keep in mind that Poland is the biggest net recipient of EU subsidies. Keep in mind that the countries that are anti-EU are the countries that profit of the EU most, and the countries that are most pro-EU are countries where people are no longer profiting off it. No one ever had to profit off the EU's back. I hate this stance where Germans are like, oh yeah, now it's other people's turn, and we Germans exploited the EU, and we made it possible for other countries to buy our cheap exports, and we introduced the euro to make our exports easier. That's all just that's plain BS. Frankly spoken, that is plain BS. Everyone had benefits, but at one point, at some point in the 2000s, when the Maastricht Treaty, the Lisbon Treaty, suddenly came into existence, the EU started to claim rights for itself. And let's be clear here: the EU has no population that is controlling the politicians directly. And this is the main issue. What we have seen over the past decades is, if you're a German, if you're an Austrian, if you're an Italian whatsoever, you're paying. Keep in mind, the Italians are net payers into the EU. That tells you a lot about the economic hardship that countries go through. And most of these countries that profit off the EU are then saying, oh yeah, Germany, go to hell. And German politicians for the past 20 years, Austrian politicians too, have just accepted this as a fact, and they meant, yeah, this is now necessary. And I think the American stance gives Europeans the opportunity to actually make something right that is wrong right now. And this is, there needs to be a leadership position in Europe, and Germany needs to step up. I hate the reaction when people are like, oh, there's a crisis in the world, the EU needs to step up its game. No, Germany needs to step up. Italy needs to step up. The French have always stepped up. So now it's Germany's turn. And it could be Germany's turn, for example, with the Chancellor Merz. I think the personal relationship between Friedrich Merz and Donald Trump is not a bad one. There are so many opportunities to work on this, to build on this great foundation. But looking at how things are taking turns right now, I don't think that Germany is using the chance that is being presented right now. And the American strategy says there's a lack of self-confidence. And yes, this lack of self-confidence will lead to the EU keeping the countries that are contained in it down. You remember the sentence, keeping the Americans in and the Germans down and the Russians out? Welcome to the EU. It's here to keep the Chinese in and the Germans down. It is, when you look at certain countries in the EU, and this is a point where we do need to take a critical look at Hungary, for example, and also at the Balkan countries. China is heavily investing in these countries. For our American viewers and listeners, let me give you one example. The EU automotive industry is being crushed. It's being crushed from the outside. It's being crushed from the inside. It is Germany's biggest employment area. Millions of Germans are working directly or indirectly in the automotive industry. most research in the automotive industry in the world happens in Germany. What's happened when you drive an American car, it's very likely that this is only able to be driven because of German technology. Now, what Germans have done over the past years is under the idea that the best product shall win, they lowered tariffs. They made it possible for Chinese products to enter the German market. They were cheaper. They were not better, but they were cheaper. So German car manufacturers have huge issues when it comes to selling cars that are being, they're no longer being made in Germany, for example. If you were to build an electric vehicle in Germany alone, it would cost roughly 80 to 90,000 euros, I think. So German manufacturers go to Eastern Europe, build their cars there. However, out of nowhere, there are Chinese cars, which are cheaper. So now for years, Germany was like, oh, yeah, we can't really do customs because then the Chinese will do retaliatory tariffs and la-di-da. Now, at one point, we've reached a point where tariffs are okay now. But guess what? It's useless. The Chinese have already constructed huge car manufacturing places in Hungary, in Romania, etc. And what we in Europe have allowed ourselves is the construction of foreign outposts. We always laughing about the, or we're always angry about how the Russians are acting against foreign actors, how the Chinese don't allow foreign actors at all unless it happens through joint ventures. How President Trump complains about foreign media, take the BBC, that unlawfully cut one of his speeches trying to insinuate that he's a criminal. He's not. We Europeans are the only ones who are like, oh yeah, no one's playing by the rules. That doesn't keep us from playing by the rules, because if you're not playing by the rules, you're a bad person. And this is the price that we're having. Just to close this part off, in 2016, on what was the election on October, November 6th or 8th, 2016?
Not sure to tell you the truth. Let's ask Dr. Google.
Okay, I think it was on
I thought April. It was on the 5th.
Oh, it was on the 5th? Okay. Let me just check, because this is important now. Oh, it was November 8th. Okay. Google AI says so. Maybe it's not true.
so does Wikipedia.
Okay. Maybe Google AI is like, yeah, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Anyway, I remember the morning of November 9th, I switched over to MSNBC, and there she was, Rachel Maddow. And she's like, this is your life now. This is your country now. This is the election now. This is the future you're living in. And for the past years, if you're a European, every single morning, when you open the newspaper, every single day, think about it. This is your country now. The EU has the world's lowest GDP growth, also real income growth. Germany has not had any real income growth over the past 6 or 7 years. When you summarize it, Germans are now stuck with what they could afford in 2018. The world has moved on, but Germany has not. And this is my summary. The world has moved on. Germany has not. We are trying to grasp the so-called rule-based international order, which Germany has always been a great supporter of. We finally got rid of the feminist foreign policy. I thought so. I'm not really sure, because the German conservative government is spending more money than any previous government on left-wing like ideas and left-wing associations. So the world has moved on, but Germany is still stuck in, yeah, I don't know, 2010? I've no idea. Probably.
I would actually, Lucas, I would second that. Probably even earlier, jog my memory. When did we have that president called Horst Köhler? Horst Köhler, I think mid-2000s, maybe?
Mm-hmm. No, that was 2000. He got elected 2005? No, 2004?
Something like that.
Resigned in 2010.
Okay, good. Well, then then Lucas is bang on the money that we are stuck there. Well, there's one thing interesting about Horst Köhler in the year 2010. Mind you, 2010, Germany was actually everybody's darling. So unlike the United States, suddenly Germany was cool. So I studied in the United States in 2010. Everybody looked towards Germany like, oh my God, they managed to actually keep their industry. They're doing well, how they're doing it. Then essentially Horst Köhler, I think around maybe 2008, 2009 said something about, well, look, ultimately the German military also serves to safeguard German interests in the world. Should be an innocuous statement. I mean, that's what you've got armed forces for, you know? I mean, if you're trading nations like Germany, yes, the German nation, the German Navy is out there to keep the various crucial commercial routes open for shipping, you know? And piracy was just upcoming and all. Should be an innocuous statement. People thought that was so jingoistic and militaristic and old school thinking, and Horst Köhler got lambasted. And what's interesting about Horst Köhler, Horst Köhler spent large part of his life abroad. So for him, having left Germany a good many decades and then having come back and having been one of our better presidents, mind you, American listeners, the German president is mere representative. He's more like a king or a constitutional monarch. He doesn't have any political power, or barely any power, as well as the chancellor is the person guarding. And so to second what Lucas says, we are in 2010 and there is still no vision. So Germany was in a really good position in the 2010s. We were able to reduce our debt, you know, that we had incurred due to the reunification. Everybody admired our economic model. Cheap gas flowed in from Russia. We had okay relations with Russia, even though our then Chancellor Merkel already started verbally antagonizing the Russians whilst growing more dependent on their gas. But there was no vision about the role of Germany in the world. What is the role that we want to play? What is the role we want to be vis-a-vis Europe? So we are stuck in that debate. We hadn't even graduated to even more exciting questions that we are into nowadays. And probably to just revisit two more points before throwing the ball back to both of you. What is interesting, you mentioned European economics. So the argument for the European Union, if you talk to Germans, they're fervently pro-Europe. And their whole shtick is always, well, you know, the world is so large and Germany is so small. So how can we, we need to be Germany because we can't compete with China and the rest of the world. And there we have to say, well, look, Europe was its most powerful when it was only European nation states circa 1914. That was sort of peak Europe, as it were. So that's not an argument. But if you're making
just
the argument...
And real quickly, Christian, I was just listening to an interview with Charles Colomb, who talked about the 30 Years' War. And the level of just land taking that, like, the Netherlands did, or the Portuguese, in places that are almost unreachable today is just absolutely phenomenal. I mean, with wooden boats, you know, the British went out and conquered islands, the Dutch went out, the Portuguese. I mean, imagine with insanely comparable size of technology. You had wooden boats and you conquered the world as individual kingdoms. And yeah. Now you have this entity as a European Union and they can't even get anything accomplished, not even a solution on what time zone or should you accept summertime or wintertime. They can't even get a solution done on that. So
you bang on the money. Yes, I mean, it is fascinating. I mean, in those days, Europe and I think Neil Ferguson, so it was kind of a historian that says mostly really good stuff, kind of making the argument that 97% of all inventions that are consequential for modernity have been made by white European men. And so Niels Ferguson says plenty of good things, only then to be sometimes really, really cocked. But also Niels Ferguson made the point that what made Europe strong was that it was this insane laboratory of tons of little states that could try things out. And one small city-state or in Germany would find something really, some policy that worked, and others would copy it throughout Europe.
I'm David Cross, and you may know me from my election integrity work, but I also own U.S. Asset Management, a family-owned and operated investment advisory practice. I'm a certified portfolio manager, and my job is to help you make better decisions with your money. One of the things we try to avoid is investing in companies that push the woke agenda. If you're invested with one of the big firms out there, there's a pretty good chance that you're feeding the beast that hates your values. Our company is 100% conservative, and we'd love to have an opportunity to work with you. Check us out at us-am.com and look for our big, proud American Eagle logo.
I'm watching my friends gain more and more weight. And then eventually, I got to tell you, this is a little dark, but a bad diet literally killed my whole crew.
Wow.
Diabetes, a stroke. I mean, all kinds of stuff. It's like you had a stroke. You're not even 50 years old. You guys got to quit eating this stuff. Your body knows what's what. You're not conscious of this. But that's why people will go to the refrigerator and they'll grab this and that and the other and put together this outrageously elaborate combination of foods. Your body's trying to reach balance. Unbeknownst to us, our bodies are always trying to reach homeostasis. You can't eat all of this stuff and expect to live a long time. And one thing led to another, and I went, you know, forget this. We're going to make our own product. So we partnered with a one of the world's top three biochemists where nutrition-specific study is concerned. I said, all I want is the best nutritional immune support product in the world. So we mix it in yogurt. It's a powder. I got a bag of it here. I keep one on the console all the time, you know, just so I can show people.
Yeah.
And it's a powder. Now, this is not candy. This is hardcore nutrition, and sugar is an enemy. And most people do not know that the reason these bellies are showing up on people all over the place, your body makes fat to store the toxins it can't get rid of. So it just puts them over here. But I can tell you this, you take this for 30 days and then lay off of it for 2 or 3 days, and you'll go, good grief, give me some more. Skin, nails, hair growing back. Cut yourself and it heals in half the time.
Whereas the highly centralized empires like China, these highly centralized empires work really, really well as long as you've got a really, really competent ruler and the policies are great. But if they're rubbish, well, so goes the empire. I mean, essentially, China could have conquered the world easily with the technology they had, but at one point they became inward-looking, highly centralized, and, well, I think there was one big storm and they're like, well, we're not going to do that anymore. And same with the Ottoman Empire, that at one moment became centralized, fossilized, decided, you know, maybe all that scientific research is kind of un-Islamic, so let's not do that. Whereas in Europe, in that insane laboratory of all the small states, and there were a lot more of those in Europe, a lot of stuff got tried, failed, copied the stuff that worked. And remember, the best army, I will always make the point, that has ever walked the face of the earth was the German army of World War I. Germany at that point, even prior to World War I and prior to that war, was probably the most innovative place in Europe in terms of invention and everything. But even going into World War I, Germany had various armies. So it's you know, it's not that huge monolithic block that people think it was.
It had four armies.
Yeah, Hanoverian army.
No. Armies, the Prussian. The Saxons, the Bavarians, the Swabians.
Yeah. And then even some regiment, some of the Prussian regiments could still had like traditional names, like calling themselves the Hanoverian, whatever. But yeah, probably weren't a proper army at that moment. But yeah, it supports my point. So the Europe's, now I'm going to say Europe's diversity actually was its strength, political diversity.
I got at one point diversity on a certain level with variation of the same thing are great. You know, yes. Johann Sebastian Bach, it's variations of a concerto. You differ the keys are different, but you're not coming in with some African bamboo drum or something.
I think that is a very apt analogy. I mean, we don't want to open up the can of worms about what about the United States? I mean, where everybody said, well, America is more an idea than an ethnicity. But, you know, I mean, there's a reason why certain states in the United States were called New England. We're not going there. But yes, so you are so correct. Diversity as a variation definitely works. It worked for Europe. One interesting thing I'm going to hand back to you. I mean, Fabian and Lucas have made the point, and the European Union is not working. And to support the point, I'm like, the argument was like, well, it's only Europe that enables us to compete with China and the United States. We have fallen back in every single metric vis-a-vis the rest of the world since the European Union was incepted in its current form in 1992. And interesting enough, the one thing that we are still priding ourselves is, well, we are the best, have the best regulation for privacy. And now we will have the best regulation in AI is what we are attempting. Like, great, we're regulating industries that we don't really have or where we play no role.
Well,
really.
I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned the European Union in its current form, because, you know, when I look at Europe, when I look at France, when I look at Italy, when I look at Spain, but especially the core Central European countries, I don't have this fake, like, liberal, humanistic, you know, let's abolish the nation type view of Europe. I have this greatness view. Like, when I look at the Italians and their just their majestic way of uniforms, or where the way that the you know the French, what the French empire left us, or even when you're standing in Stockholm and you're seeing the King's Guards with still the pickle helm, you're looking at the greatness of Europe. When you're looking at majestic cathedrals, when you're looking at all of that ancient realm that was left to us, I look at greatness. I look at that with great pride. And I look at that with great thankfulness. And at the same time, I'm looking at this with, we have an obligation, we have a duty to bring this into the new generation, to revive it, to uphold it, and to inspire it anew. And I don't want Europe to be shattered. I don't want, you know, Germany to join the BRICS nations and Poland to be, I don't know, the lead nation in a new revived NATO. And all of a sudden you have like a new, you know, Germany-Poland rivalry. That is not in our interest. It is in our interest to have a common cause. It is in our interest to be, allied. It is in our interest to have a grand narrative. It is in our interest. You know, I was listening to a Canadian the other day. He said, oh, I just wish that Charlemagne could come back and revive Europe. And there's a truth to that. You know, nobody wants Europe to be shattered. But nobody at the same time wants this bureaucratic monster that gets nothing done and just continually works in our demise and is led by very incompetent people like Ursula von der Leyen. This is absolutely insane. So what should be the direction? The direction is Europe needs to wake up to the fact that it is a civilization. And it needs to clearly identify who's going to be the lead dog in this civilizational state. I don't know if we can call it that, but Samuel Huntington always said that the West has two motors, one being the United States, the other being France and Germany. So the thing is, it is important for these states to be great. But one time I asked Lucas, when was modern post-war Europe great? And Lucas said in the 60s. And I thought that was interesting because when you look at the 60s, you look at the level of technology that was created in Europe. You look at the high-speed trains, the fact that the French said, we're going to become a nuclear power.
Or the Concorde as hypersonic travel plane.
Yeah. Pardon?
The Concorde as a hypersonic travel plane.
Airbus, all of these great leaps forward technologically, but also militarily and on the industrial side. I mean, look at, you know, when Germany was a divided country, what an industrial powerhouse it was. Next to Japan and the United States, the lead economy in the world. I mean, Europe at that time was still the center of the world because it just united so much ingenuity, innovation, power, ideas. And long after that, we have reduced ourselves to this grand bureaucratic social state that actually can't afford to pay for itself because it doesn't produce anything anymore. So what needs to happen is we need to get out of this mentality of America's the big brother and America was on the beaches and America came to save and please come again. No, no, no. What needs to happen is we need to revive the spirit of we were once an enormous civilization which was called Christendom. And we were able to defend ourselves from many barbarians. And we built civilization. And this spirit has to be revived, and not the spirit of, whoa, we're the playground of the big powers. That's because you're acting like a playground of the big powers. And that is, in essence, the civilizational state. Realize who you were and do something out of that. And that is something that modern, liberal, Brussels-oriented Europeans absolutely do not understand. They do not think in these spheres. They think in spheres of multilateralism to fight climate change and whatever. But they don't think in these realms of greatness. They don't think in the realms of the great leap forward, at the same time being in the foundations of your civilization. And it speaks volumes that, you know, you find more from, for example, the apostle to the Germans was Saint Boniface. You hear more from American Catholics about Saint Boniface than you would from Germans. So Europeans have forgotten who they were. And the only appeal I can make is learn who you were and revive that. With that being said, gentlemen, I got to go.
Well, thank you so much for your contribution.
This is a great rounding up, honestly. I don't want to add this much more. Christian, anything from your side on this?
No, I would probably second what Fabian says. Sometimes we're reminded by our brothers or colonies abroad, if I may cheekily call the Americans, that you hear, I learned more from Americans about Oswald Spengler and Carl Schmitt of late than I've learned about those two thinkers in university and high school. Actually, for that matter, Carl Schmitt had only been briefly touched in law school, and Oswald Spengler wasn't even touched in high school. And with that, I think we need to do some civilizational thinking. I think Christendom is the right category in a lot of ways. And I think we've got tons of other cool topics in terms of key moments of this year. We might actually revisit them in the new year and talk why they were crucial moments. Lucas, if you pitch it over to you, if you want to touch on those.
No worries.
All right, guys, I wish you a happy new year.
Thank you. Take care.
Nothing to add from my side. I suggest we call it an evening. And we're going to be joined next year by our good friend Todd, who we are wishing a happy new year as well. Dear listener, dear viewer, thank you for spending another year with Eurobytes, and stay safe. Take care.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.